Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
We'll get going, John. Welcome back to another episode of Save for the Blind podcast. We're here with the esteemed Dr. John Eady. John, thank you so much. And this has been a long time coming. But just want to say, one, thank you for all the work that you've done in waterfowl. And it's been getting good to know you over the last couple of years, working with college camp and everything. And I know there's a ton of CWA employees that have studied under you, and all of them have great
things
to say.
Don't blame me for that.
Well, we need to ask who is the best student.
Yeah, next question. No, I couldn't choose. Yeah, that's just actually been one of the huge benefits of this gig. It's not me, it's all the amazing students that I've been able to work with and have been gainfully employed and stayed in the business. So that's the winner.
When did you start that job that you're now retiring from?
Started here in 1995. Actually, I did my PhD in Canadian. I don't know if that'll still sneak out. I'm American now. Well, I know. Yeah, I guess I'm duo or whatever. I don't know how it works out, but I'm American citizen now. So I actually taught at the University of Toronto for 7 years, got tenure, gave it all up, and then came down here and did it again. So I came down here in 95. I taught at Toronto from 89 to 95.
And you started at Davis directly in 95?
Came down directly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, all I knew was it was a position. I mean, Davis is a great school. It was a position in waterfowl. I was teaching ecology, evolutionary biology, animal behavior in a general biology department at the University of Toronto, you know, working on waterfowl. But I was like, okay. And then this position in waterfowl came up, and it was like, this is a dream job. So gave it all up. Jane gave up a six-figure job. We moved three young girls here, starting from scratch. So we are immigrants. snuck across the border there, and been here for 30 years, and it's just been a godsend. It's been fantastic.
Now, John, where did that passion begin? I mean, did you have someone in your life? Were you always into the outdoors when you were a kid? Where'd that start?
Well, I was brought up on a farm. So in the Fraser Valley, British Columbia, it was a dairy farm. So, you know, I was always sort of, you know, always had that. It was outdoors. It was, I guess, sort of my grandfather. You know, he was a duck hunter, used to go up in the Caribou, taught me how to fish. I did a lot more fishing than hunting as a kid. We did a little bit. There wasn't a lot of waterfowl hunting on the farm. We grew up in the Fraser Valley. A little bit more, you know, some grouse hunting. We shot a few grouse, shot black birds and stuff. But, that was all good back then. So sort of my grandfather, I mean, he taught me how to fish. But then he was getting pretty old and he never went duck hunting, although he'd tell me the stories. So I kind of had that. And then when I was a young teenager, my mom got remarried and we moved to the city. So I was this country bumpkin, you know, living in a city life, and I just hated it. But it wasn't, you know, there was none of my city buddies, you know, hunted or fished or did that kind of stuff. But I did find a crowd that got into the outdoors. And so we did a lot of just real basic camping. You know, we wouldn't even take a tent. We'd take a sleeping bag, a tarp, and a case of beer, and, you know, maybe some craft dinner, you know, and head out into the bush and all sorts of places that were just pretty inaccessible. So that was always there. That was always the passion. But it really wasn't until my undergrad at University of Western Ontario with Dave Ankeny, who's you know, probably know his name, famous waterfowl biologist, and Tom Nuds. And it was there, actually, in my second year, I got hooked up in their labs and then sort of realized that there was a whole career. So I didn't, not like some kids. That's sort of one of the things I sort of missed. I wish I'd had a mentor earlier on that could have taken me out as a kid. So I hunted a little bit, but I never got good at it. Still not good at it. And it really wasn't until I got to California that I got a lot of opportunity. I was teaching in Toronto, big metropolitan city, not a lot of opportunity there. So that was part of the appeal of this job, is I just didn't feel like, you know, I wasn't a city kid. And And this just, coming to California just offered so many opportunities. So I think the outdoor passion, the connection with wildlife, liking the outdoors, liking fishing, liking hunting, just didn't do a lot of it. That was sort of always there just from growing up in the farm, and I always felt like an outcast in the city. So having said that, I think some of the skills that I learned as a city slicker, no offense to anybody listening, I shouldn't say that. But as an urban dweller, sort of allowed me to appreciate both sides, the rural upbringing, farm, what farmers go through. I work a lot with the rice industry and other agricultural industries, so I have that upbringing. I know how tough it can be. But on the same time, I've also worked in an urban environment too, and work with politicians and administrators and academicians. So kind of a hybrid entity, I guess.
So what did you go into your undergrad wanting to study, or did you just kind of go and generalize, and then once you got those classes, kind of focus towards waterfowl?
So I always loved science as a kid. I was just insatiably curious and ADD to boot. So, I was always jumping on every different thing. So I actually took chemistry and physics all the way through high school because those were the hard sciences. I only took biology to grade 9. That's all we had to do. And then, and actually it was right after my first year, I was a chemistry physics major, and I realized I hated it. Like, I don't want to spend my life in a lab. That's not what I wanted to do. It's the opposite. I like the science. And I took a year off and I worked in Jasper National Park. And that's where I really realized that there is a, I didn't have an idea that there was a wildlife profession. All I knew is there would be, you could be a conservation officer. Well, as we called them in Canada, basically a warden. And that was the job track that, I was familiar with, but like that kind of appealed to me and I wasn't really sure, but it seemed like a lot of sort of policing and dealing with the public. I didn't like people. I liked animals. And then when I was in Jasper, I just ran into all these park biologists and went, "You guys get paid for doing this? This is what I'm doing in my spare time." And I completely switched gears, and that's when I went back. I started at University of British Columbia, went back to the University of Western Ontario, and just I did 2 years of biology in one to catch up. I hadn't even had high school biology, took nothing but biology classes, and that's where Dave Ankeny and Tom Nutz gave me the Kool-Aid, and I drank it fully. So that's really, sort of a little bit of a late bloomer in some ways, which has stood me, again, these sort of experiences, I keep trying to turn the positive on them. When I'm talking to students who, so many of our students are coming from urban backgrounds, and they don't know what they don't know. You can't blame them, but they're really coming in from a very different background. They haven't grown up hunting or fishing, and some haven't even camped, kind of deal. So I can kind of relate to them. Yeah, I know what it's like coming from an urban environment and how hard it is, but it's so rewarding and there's so many ways you can get engaged, if you, particularly if you can find the right avenues, the right people to mentor you. So it's sort of, they go, "Oh, well, if you could do it, I can do it," kind of thing. So.
And John, could you speak it to like how have the students changed over time since you started and now?
Yeah, pretty significant. Yeah, I know. Well, that's a big thing. And, Jeff, as both you guys, Carson, from the student hunter camp. And again, I don't say this in any sort of, demeaning sort of way, but they're coming from very much more of an urban background. They haven't grown up, sort of hunting, fishing, outdoors. So they just don't have that experience skill set. Some of them, don't know how to change tire on a truck. Some, they haven't worked out in the bush kind of stuff. And so for me, growing up in Canada, doing a lot of time up in the bush and typical wildlife students, most of them would come from that sort of background, right? That's people that got interests. Like, I love the outdoors. I love doing this stuff. Gee, you can actually get a degree in it. Okay, well, that I'll go into that major. That's not our students these days. So before I retired, I taught our waterfowl class, and I took a survey every single year that I taught the class, just a whole suite of questions. What are you interested in? What's your background? And something like only 25% had ever hunted or fished once. And that wasn't like, that was ever kind of deal. And that's fine. That's great growth potential. And a bunch of them have never even camped or been outdoors, and they just didn't have those skills, but they were interested in it. It just means that we probably have, I don't know how many years of experience to make up for those kids, in our teaching to get them to the point where they're going to get a job and they're going to, work for an agency or an NGO. make decisions on natural resource issues and have some of that experiential background to be able to do so wisely. So it's, I think there's been a real sea change there. You know, we can ignore it, and then, you know, there's always some hardcore great ones that are coming through for sure. And I'll see those students. I'll either track them as a graduate student. It's like a college football
coach. You're recruiting scout, early.
Right? Yeah, exactly. No, I've done it. I can name a bunch of them. Dan Smith, Luke Matthews, a bunch of the guys that have gone through. And or I'll sort of set them up as mentors of these other students. You know, it's like, hey, you know, talk to Luke, talk to Dan, talk to these guys, and you know, and you know, they'll take you out, or you know, they just get to see that this is pretty fun stuff. This is a, you know, really cool pathway, and they get excited by that. So, as you'll notice in this podcast, I don't know if you have editing capabilities. You may want that, because we'll probably go into 3 hours if you let me keep talking.
Yeah, no, we'll, but, if we go over, we'll make it a two-parter.
Okay, heck, you can cut me off.
Yeah, seriously.
Cut me off, yeah. No, it torches enough to listen to part one, let alone two more. Yeah, so big change, and that's a big concern for the waterfowl profession right across the board. I've been pretty involved in that, the college camp. We can talk a bit more about that. That's just one of the best things that I think I've ever been involved in. But I've also been part of the North American Waterfowl Management Plan Committee for many years, and there's now North American Waterfowl Professional Education Plan Committee that was came out of a recommendation from the last update of NAWAMP. That really is concerned with the future training of our waterfowl professionals. And since I'm talking, I'll say two things. So one thing is, you know, there's the university training, and I think that's great. And we've got a bunch of these endowed chairs now. They've been really important. I mentioned I'm working with Julie on an article for California Waterfowl Magazine on the importance of these endowed chairs. We have 10 endowed chairs across the nation. We're losing those positions left, right, and center, teaching positions.
Can you speak to what that is, John?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, let me back up a little bit. So Rick Kaminsky, who just retired from Clemson, you know, did a study back in 2013 or so, and he surveyed something like 96 or something like that different waterfowl or wildlife programs throughout Canada and the U.S. and asked how many of them had a waterfowl program or a waterfowl class, a teacher, instructor. And I think only about 3/4 of them did. But about half of those back in 2013 said if that person left, they wouldn't refill them with another waterfowl person. So there was one gap. And then Rick and then Diane Eggman and Luke Laborde did another follow-up survey and found out that that's now down to something like 50 positions. And again, less than half would fill them. And with you know, a lot of people aging out, they estimated it could be as few as 15 waterfowl professors in the nation and Canada and the U.S.
Wow.
You know, from over 100. And these are wildlife programs, right? So there's this real drop in the capacity to teach and train. So that's one element of it that's really concerning. So actually back in 1995, the Raveling, so I've been privileged to hold the Dennis Raveling Endowed Chair in Waterfowl Biology for 30 years. It was the first one, and it was Cal Waterfowl and some private donors that got this whole thing going. And it was when Dennis Raveling passed away at way too early an age, and Dennis was just a giant in the field. And they said, hell no, we're not going to let this capacity disappear, you know, in the heart of the Central Valley. So they got together and raised an endowment to set up the very first endowed waterfowl chair. That sets up funds that now have grown over to $3.5 million. They only use the interest that comes off of that and a portion of it, because the rest goes back in to build it up. And those funds support graduate students and undergraduate students and teaching opportunities, the hunt camp a little bit, you know, all these other activities that we've done to keep training the next generation, you know, of waterfowl and wetland biologists. So it was like, okay, well, you know, if you all aren't going to do it, we're going to do it for you kind of thing, you know, so a great public-private model. Working together. There are now, then that set the stage. There was a second one at Mississippi State. Rick Kaminsky held that for a number of years. Jim Kennedy was the benefactor. And I want to shout out to Peter Stent and Paul Barneson, who were two principals at the Raveling, and a bunch of other people, Dan Connolly and Dwight Merriman. There's just huge numbers of people involved with Cal Waterfowl, Ducks Unlimited, you know, Central Valley Joint Venture folks. And that now has taken off across the nation. So there are now 10 endowed chairs, which means that there are at least 10 positions throughout the United States and Canada that will still be teaching waterfowl biology and wetland ecology in wildlife departments. That's 10, yeah. You know, so that's a worry. And here's the second part before I launched into that was, that's great. I mean, we need that academic training. I mean, you guys came through biology degrees and, you know, had that background. But as you well know, you know, that's book smart, street dumb. If you don't have the street smarts, you know, that only gets you a third of the way there. I won't even say half a way there. It gives you the basics. And you get that by experiential, you know, job training. But what I think we're really missing is that capacity to get this next generation, particularly given the gaps and, you know, their backgrounds and their experience, into the field. Even simple stuff, driving a tractor, driving an ATV, changing a truck tire in the bush, you know, working a radio, you know, not slipping in the marsh and filling up your waders, because none of us have ever done that. You know, I mean, just all the little stuff that you don't do until you get a chance to do it. And I think that's where there's a big gap. So that's kind of one of my retirement projects. I'm working with Dan Connolly and Jim Sittinger and a bunch of people, thinking about how we can provide more opportunities, not just for the academic training, but the managerial. Where our next duck club manager is going to come from. You know, that's on the ground training. There's no school that teaches that, and you couldn't teach it,
yeah.
Right? But there's no recipe. You got to learn it, and it's you know, site specific, it's year specific, it's, you know, everything. So that's a big concern for me, is where that's the gap, you know, that I see coming. That's one of the challenges that I see coming. So the endowed chairs are great. I think we need endowed, the old land grant mission, endowed cooperative extension type people out there working with farmers and stakeholders and growers and agencies, you know, that are actually doing management relevant research, not, you know, stuff that you're going to get published in highfalutin journals that nobody's going to read, stuff that people can use. That's probably, I'm probably sounding like a complete heretic here, but.
Well, like if someone was.
I'm retired, they can't fire me. But
let's say someone's in high school and they're looking at a university. I mean, you have Davis, Humboldt. Is there anywhere else in California, if you wanted to go more the waterfowl realm, where you could go?
There are, but I mean, it's sort of, it's really individual specific. You know, folks through Chico, Sac State, but although, you know, sometimes people are cycling through Cal Poly. There are other programs. And, you know, I guess I would say, you know, even having taught my waterfowl class and taught, you know, over 3,000 students, I mean, that's just the nubbins. That's just the basics. I think you could almost go anywhere with a waterfowl degree, or sorry, biology degree. But if you got that experience, if you worked with California waterfowl, or, you know, Cal Fish and Wildlife, or, you know, got summer jobs, or, you know, got some of those internships, I think you would learn almost as much. And in some ways, maybe it's not even all that biology as much that you need now, as much as hydrology or policy, or, you know, learn all, you know, sort of all the rules and regulations, or you know, limits on water availability, or soils, and, you know, some of those skills, you know. I think it's really important to have programs in waterfowl and wetlands. I do think we need to be thinking about what skills our next generation of managers need most for us to be relevant in academia. And I think we've drifted apart a little bit. We're getting into sort of highbrow conceptual issues, which are important, but that isn't addressing some of the management relevant kinds of questions that I think we have. So there's still a bit of a training gap there.
Yeah, I think this is one of the fields where, you know, the piece of paper is good and you need it, especially if you're working for a governmental agency, but the amount of experience that is important for a future job is a lot greater in this kind of realm, because, like you said, you have to say that student comes from the city, does no extracurriculars other than getting their degree, and it's like they're going to get somebody who has the same degree but has all these hours with these agencies or volunteer hours. That person's going to get picked every time. It's just so absolutely important.
Yeah. You know, I mean, when I'm looking at sort of field assistants and so forth, even if they don't have the school, you know, they don't have the courses, but they've got that experience, you know. I mean, it takes me 2 days to train them up to be out in the field versus, you know, the whole first field season or something like that. And again, I don't blame those kids that don't have that experience. That's on us and our institutions to be providing that training, you know, in some way, or find a way to do it. So that's kind of my, one of my hobby horses for the next little while. You know, I was lucky with a number of mentors in my life, and you know, what these kids need is a mentor. And actually, one of the best things, I'll say this now, I wanted to make sure that I mentioned it, is a shout out to Bob McClandris, Uncle Bob. So Bob, as you know, was the past president, and he was the head biologist before that for California Waterfowl. And then he retired. And Bob was, you know, loafing around, sending out, you know, inappropriate emails. No, he wasn't. But, and we thought, well, Bob, let's, you know, you've got this incredible experience. Let's get you into the classroom. And so we did this deal on campus where Bob would come in and co-teach with me. I mean, I gave a bunch of the lectures, but Bob would always be there with additional insights and telling me how I was wrong. And no, John, that's not actually how it works. He was always right. And it was just amazing for the students because they got this real world experience of somebody who had actually been in the trenches working with an NGO and with agencies and administrators. And then me, the egghead, you know, but with the passion for waterfowl. And they could also go to him because, you know, he wasn't grading them. So they could actually tell him what they really thought. And it was just an incredible partnership, you know, and it's lasted all the way through right up until now. Bob's still going in. It was great for the students. And it just struck me that that's another model for teaching, when you get somebody who actually has, bringing in somebody who's actually in the field, knows the real world. Not just knows the theory or the basics or the equations or the software packages and the analytical methods, somebody who's actually been there and done that. And then the kids can actually see that, and then they can relate to that. And then there's all these connections. Bob's probably written 1,000 letters of reference for students, you know, that have come through. And he buys them beer every other Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. It's meetings. Those are popular.
Yeah. So that's there's some, you know, I think there's some different models of where we can start. I don't know if we'll ever increase, you know, the bigger question then, and sort of looking at some of your questions, some of the bigger challenges, you know, I just think, how do we remain relevant to society at large? You know, that's the biggest issue. Number of hunters are going down, but they're not going down as precipitously as some people claim.
Yeah.
I think it's just making sure how, you know, that people really understand how relevant and important, you know, sort of our community is, you know, in retaining the resources that they engage and engaging more of them, you know, sort of. What is it that you do? The college camp is a perfect example. And I think you guys have seen that, right? So these are kids that have no idea. Some of the kids that come into that camp are going like, I'm not really sure how I feel about hunting. You know, I don't think I ever really want to take an animal's life. And I get that, you know, that's all a very normative part of the process. It's a very isolated part. I think in my mind, they just, you know, they just don't know. They just have not had that experience. And I remember when we first started the camp, Jeff Gust, that was back, I mean, with George and folks, I think even before your time. The first year we did it, and you guys have heard me tell this story, but I'll put it on here. I thought for sure, and this, and I will say this is a California waterfowl camp, you know, UC Davis can't really take credit for it, although it was developed for our students initially, now with Humboldt and other groups as well. But it really was California Waterfowl that made this possible, and Paul Bonderson. And anyways, that first year, I thought, my God, you know, we're going to get lawsuit. I'm going to get fired over this thing. You know, some kid's going to, you know, shoot their foot off, or, you know, or break down at, you know, sort of the first duck that gets shot or something like that. And it's never happened. We've had over 150 students through that camp, and it's absolutely transformational. I was gobsmacked. I really thought there's going to be some pushback. And I'll tell you two stories. One, you guys probably remember this from one of the films, Georgia. I won't say her last name.
I was guiding her. I was in the
Yeah. And she was, oh, that's right. Yes. And she was like just this crack shot, right? Never had shot before. And she was like knocking him down, you know, on Paul's course before going out. And there's just this real poignant thing in the film that the Cal Waterfowl made that she goes, you know, when I first went out, I shot my first duck and I cried and never killed anything before. But then I realized, you know, I'd actually was taking part in this whole sort of enterprise, and that I was, I don't have her words in front of me, but you know, I was responsible for it and I really felt empowered. And then her last sentence was, at the end of the day, I had six ducks, four mallards, and two pintail. I was back when you'd have two pintail. And it was just transformational. And then the second story was another student who was actually out with Paul's nephew, who's now a game warden, and wasn't shooting. You know, Paul and I zoom around to the blinds and check out all the students. And she was sitting back, sort of looking kind of solemn. I thought, uh-oh, okay, this one didn't work out. And, you know, there was a pile of ducks there. and I thought, okay, well, yep, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see if we get some letters from her parents. Nothing happened. And then she graduated, went on. And the next Christmas, I got a card from her with her and her dad. And she was holding a green wing. And she said, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Teal. And she had gone out and taken her sort of that year to process it. And you know, she got into it because her dad hunted. And then she went out with her dad. Her dad had bought her a shotgun for Christmas. And you know, she had slowly sort of thought through the process and come to terms with how she felt about it. And I just realized just how powerful that was for these kids that never get those experiences. And, you know, learning doesn't happen when it's easy. It happens when it's hard, when you're making that really tough decision for yourself. And then you're in. And boy, every one of those kids that have come out of that camp, and we've done follow-up surveys, have said, you know, this is one of the most important things that I did as an undergraduate, you know, in terms of learning. And it was like one weekend.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's, I'm jumping over about five different questions that you've asked. but that was probably the, you know, the most surprising and transformational part of my own career, of just like, wow, I never would have imagined. I was always very anticipant about trying something like that, and would not have if it hadn't been for you all and Paul Bonderson saying, yeah, we'll do it. So yeah. And now, you know, Delta's taken it on and played it out across the nation. A bunch of other schools are doing it on their own. So you all set the stage. So kudos to California Waterfowl for getting that thing going.
Our hunt program is still accepting applications for spring pig hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply today. We are also still accepting applications for our Camp Sprig events. We have openings in July and August. If you have a young hunter looking to obtain their hunter education certificate, this 2.5-day camp is designed to provide hands-on learning and certification. While you're there, don't miss our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Upcoming events are Santa Cruz Recruitment Meeting and Social, May 8th, Modesto Recruitment Meeting and Social, May 13th, Orange County Banquet, May 17th, Siskiyou Banquet, May 17th.
Kudos to you for heading it up and get it going. But yeah, you'd mentioned in the film that she was crying, and I'm newly hired in CWA, working for a year or two, pretty fresh out of college, and I didn't even realize it till I watched the video. I was like, oh yeah, she was a little teared up.
You're oblivious. I was like, at the mallards.
I was like,
in.
Hey, there's some. Yeah, I was kind of like, hey, here's some more ducks. I was like, if you want to.
Oh, you're probably going, oh, good shot.
Yeah, I was. I was like, great shot. I went out and grabbed it, and I was like, do you want to keep shooting? And she's like, yeah. And then I was like, okay, well, here's one right here. You know, and here's another one. So it's pretty funny.
Yeah. The downside with our camp, though, is that the kids think, oh, well, this is how you hunt. It's like, no, you know, you're not going to go to Gray Lodge or Yola Bypass, and somebody's going to provide you with the guns and the waders and the shells and the experience and
ride your birds blind, for you
and call for you, et cetera. So, yeah, that is the hard part is so many of those kids have gone, well, I'd really like to follow up on that. So maybe that's the next venture in the future. We can see, raise an endowment for that or something that, you know, we can do follow-up camps with students that would like to continue in the...
Yeah, that'd be great. And John, you mentioned earlier about mentoring, and I mean, you've taught over 3,000 students. What have you learned the most about mentoring in your experiences
It's the hands-on, you know. The in-class stuff, where the in-class stuff works, you got to have the basics, right? I mean, you want, and some of that is really just learning how to learn, learning how to listen, learning how to write, learning how to think, learning how to be critical. That's what a lot of college is. It doesn't matter what course it is in some ways. Time management, those kind of skills. I guess I would say a couple things. One is just, I'm a bit of a goofball and my, I can't suppress my passion and that sells, I mean, if they see here's this old fart and he's still excited by this, well, I guess there's something to it. I guess I'll spend an hour listening to him. So, you get a little bit of buy-in from that, from just caring about what you do. Don't hide that, don't exaggerate it, but express it, just be who you are and show. And if people learn by watching others, and when they see Bob and I jump around like a bunch of, teenagers, talking about ducks, and I go, well, I guess there's something to this. So that's one. The experiential is just, you got to get them out in the field somehow. Just giving that hands-on, mud on the boots, skin in the game, so I think that's really critical. I've learned that. And then I guess the third thing is just, I think there's a large part of academia that's not very accessible to students by design. It's the status thing. A lot of students say, man, I can't talk to my professor, or they're too intimidating. And I realized maybe that's part of just my own goofball, passionate mentality. But it's like, oh, I can talk to this guy and I can actually learn about jobs. And it seems like the door is open rather than you got to bang, bang, bang on the door. And then if I have time, I'll maybe schedule 5 minutes of office hours with you. So I think that's it, is just being open to that and encouraging it and being honest with them. It's like, this might not be the right field for you.
Yeah.
to their benefit. And I think, I'm just amazed when I see where some of our students have gone and I've received lovely letters from students saying, sort of the impact of the courses that we've taught. And you don't really realize it. And then, boy, I mean, what a huge honor and opportunity and responsibility.
Do you have any student success stories that stick out in your mind that may be above some other ones?
There's too many. There really are too many. I don't know. Just the students from the hunt camp, sort of stand out. There are just so many. When I had to sort of parse that out into the graduate students. So, I've had over 60 graduate students and I'm absolutely thrilled that so many of them and all the ones that have wanted to, I think it's like 92% or something have jobs as biologists or or some of them have gone into academics. So that's huge. And that's actually a big thing of the Ravelling, right? It's just, my job wasn't to be the biggest brain, the smartest guy in the block, the instigator of new ideas, is to train the next generation. I think that's what the Ravelling provided, and I think that's been really successful. So all of them, I couldn't single out one. I was thinking about that. Who's my top student? And I got down. I couldn't even get past 10, to be honest with you.
Was there anybody ever that was a surprise where you thought like, hey, this person might not even make it through this class, and then they're like,
I'm not going to name names, but. I'm not going to name names, but one who's a very, very dear friend of mine, I just wondered if he was going to make it through and get his thesis done. And now he has a head position at a state agency,
awesome.
Somewhere else. I mean, there's several examples. So here's the deal, Carson. I mean, a lot, and you guys probably know this, a lot of students that come into the wildlife field are not necessarily your A students, right? Because they probably spent time doing other important things, getting that experience, hunting, fishing, doing other stuff. They actually could make life balance, right? Mm-hmm. Which is supposedly the thing we're all supposed to do. And yet they're super bright. And so, sort of if you just go by, the ones who are getting, all the A's, that's not the best barometer of future success. So I often had students that were coming in that I kind of had to push the admissions committee a little bit to accept. And they have rocked it. So, I mean, that's why I can't single out a single student. I've had a number that probably would not have gone in. And then the other thing is, at Davis, we had, is gone now, but we had a master's of avian science program. And it was, the admission criteria were a little bit easier. Davis is very uppity, right? Because, it's one of the best schools in the nation for ecology. And, you have to have like a 3.5, 3.7 GPA, to get in kind of thing. It's like, come on, I don't know a lot of incoming undergraduate wildlifers with those kind of metrics. And so we had the master's program that they could get in with thing over a three, and I got some in that didn't even have that, and they all rocked it, you know, which just shows you the fallacy of the GPA, you know. They weren't going to go on and do PhDs, and we don't need a bunch of PhDs, you know, we need some, but they needed a postgraduate degree, so they got some training, learning that experience of conducting a project, managing it, you know, working with the funds, doing all the field work, all the grunt stuff. You know, it's like, oh, it's really fun for a class, but I have to do this for 2 years. You guys know what this is like. So, you know, that's important training, and that's all you need. You don't need to go and have the next, you know, Nobel Prize winning. Yeah.
You need somebody, you know, to go spend a summer out checking wood duck boxes, getting stung by bees, sticking their hand in,
yep,
in crevices.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So that's been huge. And I really couldn't single, I mean, I can single so many that might not have had the opportunity if we hadn't had the Ravelin program in place. I worry a little bit because I became sort of the prime user of the Avian Science Master's program, bringing students in for a wildlife program. Now that's gone and it's back to the ecology program. And Davis is sort of more on the PhD oriented kind of focus than the master's. So we need students that are trained at the master's level for just the master's level, and where they can do research that's not, you know, necessarily going to be published in the theoretical journals. It'll be published in Journal of Wildlife Management or, you know, more practical kinds of outlets. So that is a bit of a worry. In a lot of our wildlife programs, we're losing that real world connectivity. I think we have to keep that there somehow. There are still schools that do it. That's where Humboldt, I think, for example, Jeff, you know, you were asking, yeah, one of you were asking Humboldt versus. So the same when I first came to California was, if you want somebody, and you can talk to your own president about this, if you want somebody to design a wetland, go to somebody who graduated from UC Davis. If you want somebody who knows how to drive the tractor to actually make that wetland, go to somebody from Humboldt. Yeah. Right? And that used to really irritate me. It's like, come on, why can't Davis students drive a tractor, you know, and why can't Humboldt students design a wetland, you know? So, and I think that's certainly converged, but that was the knock. Like Davis students were book smart, street dumb, and Cal Poly students were street smart. I won't say book dumb, but, you know. And that's changing now, but that was, and, you know, I used to get in with Menzik and Barragiri about that all the time too, the Humboldt. And
well, one of the students, it was a year or two ago, said the exact same phrase and was like, mm-hmm, well, I'm not gonna drive a tractor. That's for Humboldt students or whatever. Really. And I was like,
we actually have a tractor. I mean, here's how sad it is. Davis actually has a tractor driving class, which is really awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. But for me growing up on the farm, it's like, what, there's a college course on driving a tractor? I'll major in that. That sounds like a no-brainer. Anyway, so yeah, so I, you know, we just had to be, we had to be creative in thinking about this. I think we've swayed a little bit one way or another over time. And my approach is always like, the reality is in the middle. You know, you need both of those sets of skills. And not everybody's going to have them. Some are going to be, you know, the designers, and some are going to be the tractor drivers. We need both.
So is there a project that you're most proud of, let's call it the Wood Duck Project internship at Bird Haven Ranch? Is it a project, you know, dealing with the robo ducks? Was there one that sticks out, you know?
That was a fun one. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I don't know if I would call the robo duck one fun.
What was it? I haven't heard about that.
Oh, that was the first spinning wing decoy study.
What did you guys do for the study?
Oh, well, so we got here. I was a green as a you know, as a dollar bill, just coming down from Canada, and you know, of course, spinning wings, the old RoboDuck had just been invented. It was the old football blade, yeah, style.
Mm-hmm. Goalpost.
And goalpost, yeah, right. And they came to us, oh, here's this new waterfowl biologist. Okay, yeah, you guys should do a study on that. And you remember that might have been a little bit controversial back in the day, mm-hmm, that thing. And so we did, and I remember, I won't name it, but I went to a very wealthy benefactor with Bob McClandris and Greg Garris, who was potentially going to fund the project, did not like our study design at all, this was quite a vocal individual, basically ripped me a new cloaca and it proceeded to ignore me for the rest of the hour long meeting. It was just like, welcome to California, dude. Hey, surf's up. So, you know, and it was just so controversial because people wanted to tip a study one way or another. You know, they either wanted to show it was devastating or they wanted to show it had no effect. So it was really challenging to come up with a study design. And our study design wasn't perfect. You know, it wasn't totally blind, et cetera. But that's where a couple of people, Tom Moore and Josh Ackerman, both biologists now, were actually as undergrads working, I guess maybe Josh was a graduate student then, worked on that project as a side project. And, you know, we did the study on the effectiveness of spinning wing decals, randomly turning them on and off, being able to go out with hunters. They knew when they were on or off, though that was a problem. We couldn't actually hide them. So, you know, there was a potential for bias, but then we did surveys and all sorts of other statistical ways to try to correct for it and showed that earlier on, there was a huge effect. When that first came out, it was like,
tenfold
difference. You actually had a statistical effect on it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then it dropped down to, I think, two or threefold increase by the end of the year. And then by the next year, it wasn't quite gone. It's still early season, you know, still had an effect with all the young dumb birds. And that kind of led to, I think, what, you know, the regulations about not using spinning wings till December. So we weren't taking out our local breeding birds and particularly the young ones. And then you know, a bunch of other studies followed up across the nation. I mean, it was a big deal. And I actually got FOIA'd on that. People wanted to see all of our data. I mean, that was my introduction to California. That was certainly interesting. It wasn't fun, Jeff. The Wood Duck internship project's been great because that, you know, we started that just primarily as a learning thing. You know, it's something we can do in spring quarter while the students are still in class. So that's the challenge with Davis. Students are still in class. Right through to the end of June. So that kind of, you know, that tanks them for a lot of summer jobs.
What are some of the things you guys have learned from that program? Because I'm sure you've learned a lot in 30 years.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it all started out really just, I mean, you know, the boxes were accessible. And this is, you know, we worked with California Waterfowl to get up with all the Wood Duck program and Steve Simmons and all the gang. And you guys have a Wood Duck program. That was before Brian and Jody and hundreds of people have gone through that, Jeremy. So part of it was just sort of, you know, long-term monitoring, teaching the students, you know, how to band a bird, how to measure eggs, how to look for signs in a nest of, you know, whether successful, hatch, depredated, even just getting them out there, slogging it out through, you know, bull thistle and black widow spiders and wasps and, you know, getting pooped on by ducks and stuff like that. Just, okay, this is the real world. So that was mostly it. And then actually in 2014, Bruce Lyon and I decided to go a little highbrow on it. So we got a National Science Foundation grant to actually look at the population dynamics and some of the behavioral dynamics. And I mean, these birds are weird. And actually, the more you look at any species of waterfowl, the weirder they are. So, you know, you guys know they lay eggs in each other's nests. Females mate with multiple males. Males mate with multiple females. There seems to be females that are just running all over the place like mall gangs and other females that are stay at home, you know, hens that never go anywhere. And these behaviors seem to be repeatable. We now have some population models that suggest this could be driving population dynamics and it's fairly locally specific. There was some controversy back in the day about nest box placement. That's actually what got us partly started into it. There were some folks back east that said, hey, you're killing them with kindness. You're putting up too many boxes in too close proximity. There's a lot of nesting interference and dump nesting. And there's some truth to that, but it's not absolute because you can get the same things in low population. It's part of the intrinsic biology of these wacko wood ducks. So that kind of got us interested in one of the things in my career, you know, I've sort of tried to marry these two fields, a basic interest in behavior and population biology, population ecology, what drives population dynamics and how does the behavior of individuals, because that's the core, is what behaviors of individuals do that determine what the population does. It's not, the population isn't a thing, it's an emergent property. So I've always been interested in that dynamic and population ecology has been big for waterfowl management. But I always wanted to make that relevant, to tie it back to, okay, so what? At the end of the day, you learn something about population dynamics, but how does that influence you as a manager or what you do to your natural resource planning? And that's where the nest boxes thing came in. Like, is there a better way to set up nest boxes? And And it's not so clear cut as some of those early studies suggested. And it does suggest there are intrinsic dynamics that are inevitable, no matter how you set up these boxes. But there are ways that might ameliorate it or, you know, or dampen the effects. And then recently, we've just, you know, very simple stuff, been looking at box placement and how, you know, sort of warming, summers seem to be getting warmer lately, like the last little while anyways. And we're finding that we're making omelets rather than ducklings in some of these boxes, you know. And so just even simple things like that that come from just long-term keeping your finger on the pulse, you know, to maximize what you do, minimize any negative consequences of your management. We don't want to do that. But is there a way you could do something simple that could, you know, make it a little bit better, you know, produce a few more birds? So is that, you know, and that doesn't get high grades from the university administrators. Like, John, we don't think it's very important that you, you know, you're concerned with how many wood ducks are being produced in the Central Valley. Fred over here got a Nobel Prize for finding a new cure for cancer. What are you doing? It's like, okay, well, I hear you. So trying to balance those two things has always been kind of fun.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.